the 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Good afternoon and welcome, everybody. You are in the session entitled Routine and Rapid HIV Testing. Are we ready to throw out human rights from HIV testing policy? I am sure that everyone is here because it's such a hot topic. It's something that clearly has emerged in this conference as being a matter for significant debate. The objective of the session is to learn from programs that have adopted the routine testing approach, whether through an opt-in or an opt-out strategy. So we've got a number of presenters who will talk to us about those issues. My name is Sisonkem Simang. I work with the Open Society Initiative for Southern Africa, and I will ask my co-chair to introduce herself before we go straight into the session.
Good afternoon, everybody. I hope everyone's had time for lunch. My name is Rachel Ong. I'm an advisor for the Asia-Pacific Network of People Living with HIV and AIDS. I'm also sitting on the Program Coordinating Board for UNAIDS. And with no further ado, I'll introduce Joanne Chetter. She's going to talk about routine testing. Are we ready to throw human rights out of HIV testing policy? Joanne is the Executive Director of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network, an organization that addresses human rights concerns raised by AIDS.
Good afternoon, everyone. The campaign for universal access has highlighted the need for scaling up of all parts of the response to AIDS. My presentation, can we get that one up, please? Thank you. It's a matter of urgent concern that so many people living with HIV, as we have heard so many times, are unaware of their HIV status. The question, though, of course, is how a scale-up of testing should be undertaken and how scaling up testing is linked to other elements of the AIDS response. The approach to HIV testing adopted by most countries and recommended up till now by the World Health Organization, usually known as Voluntary Counseling and Testing, VCT, reflects a concern for safeguarding the rights of those tested. In the early years of the epidemic, it was understood that protecting the privacy of those who would be tested and giving them basic information about dealing with HIV before the test might be the only means possible of encouraging them to seek testing. Hence, the so-called three C's that are listed here: confidentiality, consent that is informed and specific, and counseling before and after the test. Again, these were meant to build in some protection of to people who were, in many cases, already marginalized, stigmatized, and sometimes criminalized. In recent years, as I don't need to tell you, influential clinicians and policy people have called for approaches that would rather emphasize initiation of HIV testing by health service providers. These approaches may take the form of offering testing, even recommending it in a routine way in some circumstances. It is not always clear in these cases whether routine offer includes a well-developed process of informed consent or counseling. For routine testing, on the other hand, there is, in theory, the ability to refuse the test, but not an emphasis on informed consent. I think Dr. DeCock, and I beg forgiveness if I misheard him this morning, talked about testing approaches where informed consent is actually defined as the right to refuse. I guess I would like to submit that informed consent and the right to refuse are two very different things. I'm reporting today on a consultation of frontline service providers, people living with HIV from 11 countries, researchers, and UN officials that was held last October in Montreal. A full report of that meeting is available at aidslaw.ca, as is a human rights analysis that my organization was requested to write. The questions I will attempt to treat briefly, much more briefly than I was informed that I would have, are these. What are the criticisms of VCT that have been raised by those who are calling for provider-initiated approaches? What are the human rights concerns that go along with that? And also, as I have time, what is the research that's needed to inform this debate? As was reiterated to us by a WHO official yesterday at the well-attended testing roundtable, current WHO policy is to encourage routine offer for some populations, notably pregnant women in some circumstances, but to emphasize that routine offer includes sufficient pretest counseling so that informed consent can really be thought of as informed. And there even is a definition of the information required for informed consent in the 2004 policy statement, and that would include some notion of the consequences of being HIV positive, some notion of the treatment and care that are available in a given setting, and other elements. People also, according to WHO, must know that they have a right to refuse a test. A widely cited Lancet article by Dr. Dukak and colleagues that was published at the time of the Barcelona conference laid out a case against over-reliance on traditional VCT. I think it's still worth considering these arguments since this piece is so often cited and since many of these same arguments continue to be used. They said, and I'll be brief, that VCT with the three C's has not proven itself agile, fast, rapid enough to respond to the urgency of AIDS as it is today, that especially in highly affected countries, HIV awareness was already very high, so perhaps the notion of the need for pretest counseling in particular would be not what it was at the time, early in the epidemic. It is also, I think, sometimes suggested that pretest counseling may be less necessary in an era when treatment is available. Thirdly, that human rights protections only add to stigma and that routinizing or normalizing testing would decrease stigma. And finally, that VCT and its proponents may be said to be undermining social justice if we restrict people's access to testing by insisting on these elements. There is obviously the implicit suggestion that social justice is a greater good than human rights. All of the elements of the three C's are well enshrined in human rights, and I've given a very brief synopsis here of what that means. Informed consent is derived from the right, what we call the right to security of the person, the right to have control over what happens to one's body, as well as the right to receive information. These same rights, which are well enshrined in international treaties, are important as a justification for pretest counseling. Post-test counseling obviously addresses the right to information, and confidentiality is about, again, the well-enshrined right to privacy. There's an important consensus that the right to health is not just about access to services, but to services of a well-defined quality. And a core element of that is that services should be designed as much as possible to minimize human rights abuse, including discrimination, that may actually be associated with the intervention or the service. WHO has reviewed the literature, or commissioned a review of the literature, looking at what really are the human rights abuses that are associated with HIV disclosure and testing around the world, in this case with a focus on Africa and Asia. I'm not going to read these figures. They are, to me, shocking figures. And it seemed in the Montreal consultation that this led very directly to this question. If pretest counseling, as these authors suggest, can help minimize these abuses or allow women and others to deal more effectively with them, why are we not scaling up pretest counseling rather than seeking to minimize it? Many of the evaluations of provider-initiated testing have focused on a single outcome, namely the uptake or the rate of HIV testing. Again, a concern that emerged from our consultation is, what if in raising the rate of HIV testing we are including in the net a great number of people who are not well prepared to be tested, who don't have information to deal with the possible abuses that may be associated with disclosure of their status, and don't even know how to speak about disclosure, all things that are addressed in good pretest counseling. Again, a successful testing policy, and one that, in my view, is consistent with our goals of universal access, would seek to minimize these negative outcomes as well as to instill in people confidence in the health system that they will indeed need for longer-term care if they are HIV positive. I think I'm going to have to skip over that one because of time, but we can come back to some of those things in questions. Again, this question, to get back to some of the initial concerns about VCT, about whether routinizing testing will reduce stigma is an empirical question that merits research. It does strike me as a challenging thing to research in an ethical way, but it also strikes me that in the places where we have more or less routine testing, such as in entering the military in some countries, in getting certain kinds of jobs in some countries, those restrictions that should not apply but do, we don't really have any evidence that this kind of testing reduces stigma. Stigma and abuse, we must remind ourselves, are alive and well, and there are relatively few good practice efforts that are pointed to as successes to address them. A lack of confidence in the health system must be part of the equation of this matter of routinizing testing. So in conclusion, we were in the Montreal consultation, I should say the participants were very much seized by the idea that ensuring access to HIV testing with counseling, informed consent, and confidentiality is indeed well established as part of the human rights obligations of governments. That testing services should be designed to strive to minimize abuse and maximize benefits, including the link to treatment, and that indeed more documentation of experiences of routinization of testing is sorely needed. In addition, we thought that, I should say the participants thought that that research is needed on exactly what kinds of elements of pretest counseling may in fact have the potential for helping people to reduce and deal with adverse outcomes of testing and disclosure. Obviously, as said already, whether there is a link between routinizing testing and stigma reduction. And also, and I think that this is a key element of how we are evaluating the inevitably rolling out experiences of provider-initiated testing, how are those experienced in real life by people, especially in places where there are perhaps educational or class differences between those seeking testing and those offering it? We need resources to be sure that these elements that protect human rights related to testing are well funded. If there is routine offer, it should be made with a clear policy and good practice of informed consent and pretest counseling. We need to monitor emerging experiences, and that means governments must allow independent researchers to be part of that monitoring. And especially, as always, we need to ensure that people living with HIV are part of this process. They are, after all, the experts in whether stigma and discrimination programs are really working. Universal access really is impossible without human rights. Those who call for routine testing and say that there should be systems of protection against stigma and discrimination, I want to challenge them to show us where the good scale-up plans are for those programs and where the plans are that will lead to interventions that are robust enough to help deal with the human rights challenges of people who are deeply criminalized, of an increasing trend of criminalization of HIV transmission and exposure in the world, and the entrenched, horrific, catastrophic human rights situation of sex workers, people who use drugs, and men who have sex with men. I believe that this discussion hit a low point, actually, with the accusation that those who are in support of human rights protections around testing were against social justice. There is no need to pit social justice against human rights because there is no social justice without human rights. The Montreal consultation believed heartily that the case is compelling for scaling up HIV testing with every element possible for reducing the adverse outcomes of testing and disclosure. Ladies and gentlemen, the debate on testing seems to me sometimes to be happening as though the problems of living with HIV-linked stigma and criminalization were solved, and as though people's right to treatment and support were already guaranteed. Where, again, is the universal access strategy for strengthening real and concrete legal protections for the rights of those living with HIV and those affected, and ensuring the enforcement of those protections? It is not enough to promote, human rights now and forever, or whatever it was, slide, sorry about that. it's not enough to promote routine testing and add, oh, there must be the usual vague stigma and discrimination programs. We need real leadership from governments, from the UN, from donors, and from civil society for the massive resources that are needed to address the still neglected matter of the human rights of people living with AIDS and those at risk. Thanks.
Thanks, Joanne. We will take questions at the end of this session, so let's allow each of the presenters to speak. And also, a number of people continue to arrive, and so that it's less disruptive, if people sitting in the aisles could move one seat in at least so that you allow space for people as they come in. Our next presenter is Sunday Musa. He's a medical laboratory scientist specializing in virology and hematology. He serves as a public health educator amongst youth in northern Nigeria, which he's been doing for the last 9 years, working with the Fellowship of Christian Students. Thank you, Musa.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to share our experience in the Fellowship of Christian Students with you on the facilitation of VCCT guidelines for churches in Nigeria. The outline of the presentation, I will be telling you a little bit of the background of FCS and how it had to go into facilitating VCCT guidelines for churches. And then we'll be looking at the background of the initiative and then the process that we undertook, highlight key results from the process, highlight the lessons learned, and then challenges and recommendations. The Fellowship of Christian Students, FCS, is a Christian youth organization that has been working among young people in northern Nigeria for the past 49 years. By next year, we will be celebrating our 50-year anniversary. And the work covers 19 states out of the 36 and the Federal Capital Territory. The population coverage for the membership is about 7 million people, essentially children and youth. The target groups, the target communities are schools, about 83 primary, 2,758 secondary, and 140 tertiary institutions. And regularly, on a yearly basis, we cover about 200 churches. The Fellowship of Christian Students has a project called Aid for AIDS and Design for the Family, with the goal to eradicate HIV/AIDS and with key strategies, including capacity building, essentially life skills, education in schools, in churches, and then church mobilization and equipping for appropriate and comprehensive HIV and AIDS intervention, family life development, and another strategy being advocacy. And it's under the advocacy strategy that we feature prominently voluntary confidential counseling and testing. We also are grossly involved in partnership across the country. And apart from the project that FCS has on HIV and AIDS, we also mainstream HIV and AIDS work in the regular evangelism and discipleship. The issues that led to this work, as churches are beginning to understand the importance of HIV testing, they are making HIV testing for people who are preparing for wedding mandatory. But they do not have system to counsel and to care. There is no confidentiality in giving test results. There is no church wedding for persons who test positive. No church policies clearly documented existing for the testing initiatives they are embarking on. This particular initiative was based on two churches, the CMML, that is Christian Missions in Many Lands, with 105 congregations in four states out of the 36 states, with about 10,450 membership. And the second is Christian Evangelical Fellowship of Nigeria, CEFN, with 346 congregations in 16 states, with about 50,000 people. And actually, I had to undergo the mandatory testing for one of the churches, CMML, before I got married. So the purpose of this project, of this initiative, is to promote healthy voluntary confidential counseling and testing for HIV prevention and quality care and support for the infected and affected in the churches and communities. The process we engaged in, we started by sensitizing church leaders by visiting them, and essentially the management teams of each of the two churches that we worked with. And then we went on to do needs assessment using focus group discussion with key stakeholders. And I would like to tell you what we refer to as the key stakeholders: youth, who are directly affected by the mandatory testing; women, who often feel and bear the greater part of the burden of children's pain and crisis; pastors, who are directly involved in handling any crisis that comes with positive tests without the counseling, the pre-test counseling, and without post-test counseling in place; men, who champion family decisions in those communities; and church leaders, who are the policy makers. The next step, what we actually did in the needs assessment, was to engage in focused group discussions with these key stakeholders and find out how they feel, find out what they know about the system that the churches have in place, or whether there are no systems at all. We then went on to have consensus building workshop, essentially bringing fewer members of the key stakeholders to interact in the workshop setting, and then to get them to suggest the various guidelines that they would want, because after the needs assessment, we got to know that they were asking for guidelines that could foster a single common voice among the churches. And then we went on to feedback to the senior leaders in the consultation, and then we went on to draft the policy, because the leaders asked us to go ahead to use conventional guidelines to draft a policy for them. And we did that, fed back to the leadership, and then the management team went on to revise it, and then review it, and then to push it forward for approval. We came up with lots of needs that they identified, but just to highlight a few, there happened to be that participatory needs assessment that we engaged in made it clear that there is need for comprehensive and sustainable education on HIV and AIDS in the two churches. Policy on HIV counseling and testing was needed for common voice and practice in the churches. Pastors need counseling skills for effective VCT services. Key results included increased openness to discussion, increased awareness of human rights among the key stakeholders. There was a halt in mandatory HIV testing. Policy papers were developed for each of the two churches. Common voice on HIV counseling and testing, essentially focusing on voluntary confidential counseling and testing, was obtained. CMML Church now has HIV-AIDS committee that is responsible for HIV-AIDS prevention initiatives and to put in place system for the voluntary confidential counseling and testing. Let me just show you two, one each for the churches as examples of policy statements. The CEFN has as number 2.10 of their policy statements that CFN mission shall provide joint visiting services to prospective couples and married partners, and shall not engage in involuntary disclosure of HIV and AIDS status to other family members, which is one of the things they were doing before. The CML has this. CML churches shall not refuse to provide church wedding services to members on the basis of their HIV seropositive status. Lessons learned. Involvement of key stakeholders was pivotal in the process. Church leaders have good intentions for asking members to take premarital HIV testing, only that they need capacity building to do it well. Capacity building of churches on HIV and AIDS remains a huge need. Churches are willing to adopt good practices, and mobilization is a need. Churches have good structure for effective voluntary confidential counseling and services, counseling and testing services. The challenge is, one of them is to get church leaders to see the place of children, youth, and women in church policy development process. Another is inadequate funding to meet up with the capacity building needs and demands of the churches. As they have come to see the need for this system to be in place, they are now asking us, come train our pastors, our church leaders on HIV and AIDS. And then they are asking us, come train them on counseling skills. But the resources to do this is what we do not know where it will come from at the moment. Increasing demand for similar process from other church denominations. Recommendations to the faith community. Projects to change mandatory testing should adopt a participatory process of consultation. Identify key leaders through which to enter a church leadership in any work with churches. The young and the women should be considered as key stakeholders in any church initiative. Rosemary Adeyi, a woman participant, said, I sincerely desire that the mission, that is the church, should embark on VCCT and follow vividly every guideline we have provided. My expectation is met. I want to acknowledge Tearfund Asset Uganda, SUA, that's the scripture you know. Okay. Thank you.
Our third speaker is Dr. Miriam Techtmeyer, who is an infectious disease clinician and former director of the Liverpool VCT project in Kenya. She will be addressing the national scale-up of voluntary counseling and testing in Kenya, which has potential for abuse in the counseling room.
Good afternoon, and thank you. My name is Miriam Techtmeyer, and I'm privileged to be presenting on behalf of the Liverpool VCT Centre in Nairobi. It's a Kenyan NGO which is giving technical assistance to the establishment of VCT and currently has helped establish over 400 VCT sites in Kenya. I'm also presenting on behalf of Christine Hamilton, a master student from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. This work was conducted in Kenya, where we've seen a very rapid scale-up of VCT from 300 to over 700 sites in the last 5 years. I've not included in this talk aspects of testing such as opt-out testing, prevention of mother-to-child transmission, where Kenya has over 1,000 sites, diagnostic testing or opt-out testing, as we've said. I've really focused on client-initiated or opt-in testing, the traditional voluntary counselling and testing with its 3 C's models. It's a one-stop service in Kenya where pre-test counselling, testing and post-test counselling are conducted in the same private, confidential space. And it's regulated in Kenya by guidelines and a registration system. There's been a lot of emphasis, I think globally, not just in Kenya, on rapid scale-up. And the rapidity of scale-up has been accompanied on the whole by quality assurance structures for testing and some very basic quality assurance structures for counselling. And I would include amongst these the registration system in Kenya, whereby nationally registered sites get free test kits in exchange for data from the government. There's also set out in the guidelines selection criteria for counsellors, a basic standard training. And counsellors in Kenya can fail that training even if they've paid to go on that course or their organisation has sponsored them. So it sets a standard there. Registration also demands that organisations opening VCT sites have a basic supervision system in place. And by this I don't mean administrative line management But I mean the counselling support supervision that's based on trust and on counsellors getting counselling. There are also some quality assurance measures to do with the counselling, and I think this is a much more tricky area because we're very limited on our tools for assessing the quality of the counselling that goes on in the room. Some sites, including most of the sites established by Liverpool VCT, conduct client exit interviews, but these in themselves are a limited tool. Once that door is closed and a client is in there with a counsellor, it's hard to know exactly what the quality of the counselling is. And we set out to explore some of these issues within of quality of counselling, in particular the potential for abuse, both with VCT providers and with VCT service users. Our other objective was to document some of the perceptions of best ethical practice in VCT, but I'm not going to mention this further in this talk. And the thing that drove us to conduct a very rigorous study on this was that there had been some allegations within VCT sites, one of a rape. A client alleged that a counsellor had raped her in the VCT room, and one of a male VCT counsellor doing breast examinations, unnecessary breast examinations, in a VCT room as part of the VCT process. A study was conducted between November and April 2004 in three geographically very different areas of Kenya, with a variety of VCT service models, including sites in government health centres, including standalone sites, including sites within churches. We interviewed 80 people in 49 interviews, and we interviewed both service users and service providers. About half the sites had been given technical assistance by the Liverpool VCT Centre, so reflecting the national average. Key informants that we interviewed included Ministry of Health people, NGO leaders, technical assistants, donors. Service users were sampled by snowballing techniques, starting with post-test clubs, natural groups formed within VCT sites. And we also interviewed VCT counsellors through their supervision groups. The interviews were primarily conducted individually, but some were conducted in pairs and some in triads. A variety of different methods were used, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into the trustworthiness of the data, but to say that the study did focus a lot on ensuring that this qualitative data was giving trustworthy results. And the researchers themselves were trained in all aspects of counselling. In fact, there were professional counsellors that were used. Most of the respondents had very positive experiences of VCT. They said things like, VCT has changed my life, the counsellor was so supportive. They commented specifically on the sensitive, confidential handling of issues, the solution-focused sessions, the time that was given to them as individuals to help them make decisions. But a theme that came up quite frequently was that poor quality counselling led to negative experiences in VCT. And varyingly, people called these abusive experiences. Here's an example from a female service user. I'll just let you read it. Abusive counsellors was also described abusive counsellors by clients. For example, I had a male client who came in. When I came to the part on the condom demonstration, he said, "Madam, I hope to show you something." He just sat down on that chair and he pulled out his penis. And I asked him why he did that now that he'd come for an HIV test. And the client said, "If I sit near a woman, I feel like having sex." Counsellors also described things like being pinned against the wall, clients coming in with a gun, threatening them. It was quite difficult for the interviewees to come out and share first-hand experiences of sexual abuse. But through supervision sessions, things came up about what might have been happening with counsellors against clients. You get counsellors sharing what is happening. Others were molesting some children or molesting girls who had come for services. All of the programme managers had heard about sexual abuse. And I've picked one of the most disturbing quotes, but I would say every single programme manager had something similar to say. One of the most difficult experiences I had is when a client said she'd been raped within one of our counselling rooms. She told me she'd come to VCT and she was told, "You know, there's another test which has to be done with my penis." So then the counselor put a condom on, and he penetrated her, and he came. She was so confused now. We also set out to explore some of the reasons behind this in the research. And we discovered that this kind of thing is happening in other healthcare services. We heard about it with ENT surgeons, with gynecologists, with clinical officers. And the VCT interaction seems to reflect gender and power norms in health services and societies, because ladies are vulnerable in the community. The very structures that we employ for VCT, with the private sign, the closed door, could be contributing to making people vulnerable. And once you're in that private room with a closed door, you're discussing very sensitive issues around emotions, around sex, around sexuality. And those could also be contributing to these abusive experiences that are happening. And as a result of this research, we had quite a high level of concern as programmers. And we started to try and change our practice, in particular increasing the number of mystery clients that we were using in our quality assurance, and increasing the amount of information we were giving to people in the community about what exactly it's okay to happen in a VCT room. Finger pricking is okay. Penis tests are not okay. I think I want to end on a sobering note. The abuse described and documented in this study was conducted in a supposed safe environment. It was primarily perpetuated by men against women. And it's quite scary that this could be happening as we're driving to scale up. And it makes me want to give a note of caution to the pressure for scale up, and to say that, you know, let's do this carefully, let's talk about things, and let's really concentrate on the quality of the counselling services that we're scaling up here. I'd just like to make the following acknowledgements. Thank you so much.
Our next presenter is Dr. Frances Martinson, physician and public health scientist, who is currently the country director of the University of North Carolina project in Malawi.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to share with you some of our experiences in Malawi. This afternoon, I want to share with you our experience on the impact of routine counseling and testing with an opt-out strategy compared to a VCT implementation of PMTCT services in Lilongwe, Malawi. I stand here on behalf of a number of organizations, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the UNC project in Lilongwe, Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation, USAID World Food Program, and UNICEF. These are the groups which have been supporting the program that we've been doing. The University of North Carolina has been in Malawi for over 15 years. Over the last 4 or 5 years, they have been talking to the Minister of Health regarding the PMTCT services which were unavailable in the country. And by 2002, April, the ministry had agreed with the university to set up PMTCT services in Malawi using an opt-in strategy. 3 years into the program, with the recommendation of the ministry again, and in collaboration with the ministry, the strategy was changed from an opt-in program to an opt-out program. The program provides services in 4 main sites: 1 central hospital, which is Baltimore Hospital, and 3 health centers. The program currently provides services to about 20,000 new antenatal patients every year. The overall objective of the program is to reduce the risk of maternal to child transmission of HIV through integration of health education, especially HIV and AIDS education, routine counseling and testing, developing prophylaxis to mother and infant pairs, in addition to the existing maternal and child health care delivery system, which is also provided by the system. The program has a number of components. There is the HIV educational component, which is given to every woman coming into the program. There's also the routine testing, which is available to pregnant women. The program also provides basic healthcare services like HIV testing and syphilis testing, in addition to supplemental vitamins and minerals, which are provided to everybody coming. These are luxuries in Malawi. In addition to that, since May 2006, the program has started providing back training to all HIV positive mothers. Also, since last month, the program has started providing CD4 counts for all women who are going through the program who test positive. There is also a provision of a comprehensive obstetric care for everybody who goes through the system. In addition, we provide single-dose nevirapine to mothers at week 32 of gestation and also to infants at delivery. There is provision of a comprehensive postnatal care to mother and child, including vaccinations to all children who come through our unit. And now, in the last 2 months or so, Bactrim is being provided as prophylaxis to all children of mothers who are HIV positive until somewhere around 12 months to 18 months when we know their HIV diagnosis. We are also currently providing support for a support group of infected women and also for breastfeeding groups so that they are able to keep those people who partake in this program. Prior to April 2005, we had an opt-in strategy which involved daily sensitization of antenatal women in the waiting areas. Thereafter, women were put in small groups of 8 to 12 and then counseling provided to them. Then we went further to see individual women and do a lot of one-on-one counseling, which normally took between 45 minutes and an hour. And thereafter, there was an oral consent process. Testing was then done on one basis, and then post-testing done thereafter. All women were advised to deliver in the health centers that they were seen in. The opt-out strategy, which we introduced in April 2005, had a very slight different approach from what we're doing. Women who were seen in the waiting room were still provided with education, and then newly registered women were still counseled in groups of 8 to 12. However, there were very subtle changes that were put in place. After the group counseling, women were then asked or offered HIV tests. Women who were not interested were offered opportunity to decline the test, but they still received all the ANC services that they needed for the day. Those who were interested received their testing one-on-one basis. And then thereafter, they had their post-test counseling. People who had opted not to take part in the test but came on later on in their pregnancy and were interested were also offered this opt-out strategy. For both processes, the rapid test was being used, and we used both Determine and Unigold in parallel. And people who were concordant for positive for the two tests were designated as being positive, and those who were concordant negative were designated as negative. The Bioline rapid test was used as the tiebreaker for those who were discordant. At week 32, mothers were given nevirapine to take at delivery. Also in the opt-out strategy, women who came in at week 32 were offered infant feeding counseling and were encouraged to come to the clinic as soon as they deliver for the syrups for their kids, and those who delivered in the clinics were offered the syrup as soon as they delivered within 24 hours. I want to share with you the data that we collected 9 months before we started the opt-out process and compared to the 9 months after we started the opt-out process. As I said earlier, on a yearly basis, we have about 20,000 women coming through the system. So for the opt-in process, the 9 months prior, we saw about 15,000 women. Out of that, 76% offered to take the test. And about the same number of people, 76%, actually got a test. Out of those, were about 14.8% HIV positive. When we switched over for the following 9 months, once again, there were about 15,000 people who were interested in being offered a test. And 98% of these people were counseled and offered the test. And once again, the number of people who were positive was about 14%. In conclusion, it's either by switching over, there was an increase of about 24% of people who just agreed to have HIV testing. There was also an uptick of nevirapine prophylaxis to mother and infant press during this period. A few recommendations that we gave to the Ministry of Health following this experience that we had advised the Ministry of Health in Malawi to change over to an opt-out process and also to have single-dose nevirapine available to all women in these places. We also asked that there needs to be a pre-packed nevirapine syrup system for mothers to take home so that for those who deliver home, the nevirapine can be made available to them. There are a few goals that we set ourselves from our experiences that we have gone through. We have asked the country to look at using our experiences in the long way as a model for the country to expand on. And also, we are also asking the system to move towards the opt-out program so that everybody in Malawi is able to enjoy the benefits of what we are doing. We have not only done that, we've also asked the ministry to help us get men involved in all that we do in this NTCT program. The Safe Motherhood program has also been incorporated into our program with the aim of making sure that every woman who goes through the system is able to enjoy VCT. This is our modest place that we work out from. I'd like to acknowledge all the people from Lisbeth Glazer, AIDS Foundation, USAID, UNICEF, and all our other collaborators, and especially our people that we work with, the project employees who have made this possible. Thank you.
Our last speaker for today is Denise Seraphim. She's a psychologist and technical assessor of the Prevention Unit of the National Program on STD and AIDS of the Ministry of Health in Brazil. She will be addressing counseling in the use of anti-HIV rapid tests, the experience of the Brazilian AIDS program.
Good afternoon to all of you. I am happy to have the opportunity to tell you about counseling rapid testing in my country. It's necessary to say first about the context in the 2004 year. Context: HIV diagnosis. low rates of HIV testing, late diagnosis, evaluation of rapid test algorithm for HIV diagnosis, improvement of access to HIV diagnosis is a priority to the Brazilian National STD AIDS Program. Counseling, highly valorized in the diagnosis of HIV and other STD, is still concentrated in specialized health facilities like VCTs or HIV treatment centers. Risk evaluation and the anti-HIV test offer are done in all ordinary health consultations. Adaptation to primary care facilities, possibilities and limits. Relevance of the anti-HIV rapid test. Increase in the offer of HIV diagnosis, especially in regions of restricted access, precarious laboratory and health service networks and insufficient human resources. Improvement in the rates of people who don't return to pick up the test's results. Research showing high acceptability for the rapid test. Recurring question. Rapid test, should counseling also be rapid? Implementation. State of Amazonas, biggest state in Brazil. Access mainly by water, rivers, and air. Diagnosis concentrated in the state's capital. Selection. 12 municipalities and 14 health facilities. Brazil and South America. One idea, state of Amazonas, the locals in red points. Stages, development of specific training on counseling for rapid test, 16 hours. Elaboration of counseling protocol considering rapid test specificities. Guiding questions, would there be difference in performing counseling when using rapid test for diagnosis? What would the main challenges be? Training for two groups of 19 and 20 people. Professional profile, multidisciplinary team. Most of the health professionals didn't have any experience with counseling or HIV/AIDS related issues. Contents of training. Health professionals' perception of the new technology, reliability, availability, concepts, counseling, vulnerability, risks, objectives and contents of the counseling process, particularities of the rapid test, what are the changes, dramatization of pre- and post-test counseling sessions, readings of the counseling protocol, development of instruments for monitoring and evaluating the implementation in the health facilities routine, script for counseling observation, interviews with health professionals, facilities, managers, and patients, monitoring visits in 12 health facilities 4 months after implementation. Considerations for training, from training, the health team's perceptions about the health facilities, confidentiality, high demand, priority given to pregnant women, about counseling, same as the ability to deliver a positive test result, vulnerability, frequently interpreted as risk. Fast delivery of test results seems to be more difficult. About training, expectations of practical contents, requests of observing a counseling session in the health facility. From monitoring, challenges of rapid tests, immediate delivery of test results. Health professionals feel more anxious and insecure compared to the traditional methods. Some facilities postponed the delivery to the next day. Counseling protocol. little used in the routine, besides reading and practice activities during training. Difficulties non-specific from rapid tests. Professionals with little or no counseling experience. Dealing with subjectivity. Counseling limited to information. Risk evaluation done without considering specific vulnerabilities nor the individual needs for testing. Negative results permanently devaluated as opportunities for preventive approaches. Cultural and language barriers. The approach of indigenous and the Spanish-speaking people becomes limited. About training, counseling training when using rapid tests is necessary. Technical content remains basically the same. Special attention for handling the anxiety associated to delivery of the test results. Cases, discussion, and dramatization should use real examples from the health professional's daily practice. Some recommendations about monitoring is essential too. Identify the particularities of each local facility and technical skills. Reinforce some of the information and discuss the barriers that have been found. Perspectives, process of implementation in other states, priority given to VCT centers and maternity clinics. Development of distance learning course on STD AIDS counseling. Lessons learned. The use of rapid test technology has contributed to the debate on counseling contents, types, and paradigms. The test methodology does not change the need of understanding the subjective aspects of each patient. STD-AIDS counseling remains as an important practice for prevention in health facilities and for the promotion of comprehensive health care. Thank you. I'm sorry, my English.
I'd like to thank the presenters for their diverse and challenging perspectives which link disclosure as an impertinent factor in routine and rapid testing. They have provided a very broad perspective. We only have half an hour for questions and answers. I'd like you to come up to the microphone. Be as brief and concise as you can. If you would like to introduce yourself and who you are directing the question to. We will take two questions each time and then we'll answer your questions. Maybe we can start at microphone one. For the people upstairs, if you'd like to have any questions, the volunteers can come upstairs and they will give you the question and answer cards, the question cards.
Yes, Roger Deedles from UCLA. I have a question that's been troubling me for some time. The epidemic is driven by people who do not know they're infected. The most, or one of the most vulnerable and powerless groups in the face of the epidemic is wives. My question is this. Does a gentleman who declines to be tested out of fear or for whatever reason, then have the right to infect his wife? What are the rights of the wife in this situation? Thank you.
I'm sorry, but when you are asking your questions, it will be good to know that who you're directing the question to, if you have it directed to anyone.
I don't remember the names of the speakers, but the lady to your immediately.
Okay,
right,
the names are actually on the table in front of us, so that would be Joanne. Thank you.
I think we're alternating between mics, so you go ahead at number two.
I have a question for the woman from Kenya with the abuse in the counseling room. I just wondered, it seems like at a practical level, if you just had women counseling women and men counseling men, that might improve the quality overall. Can you comment on that? Is that not a practical solution in the setting that you're working in?
Sorry, do you mind saying who you are?
Emily Erbelding from Johns Hopkins, Baltimore.
Sorry, there's three microphones, so. There's four mics. In any case, there's a microphone.
There's one in the back, but let's just use three for purposes of ease. So let's take three questions in a round, and then we'll answer them. So you ask the last question, and then we'll take another round.
For the speaker talking about the sexual abuse among the counselors, I'm curious. I'm Robert Klitzman from Columbia University in New York, by the way. I'm curious about the training of the counselors. In other words, who the counselors were, what kinds of training they had. Would that have been immediately obvious that they were not sufficiently trained, or were they thought to be sufficiently trained and engaged in the abuse anyway?
Would Joanne answer the questions, and then maybe Miriam?
I think that women have the right to be able to leave unsafe unions, and that right is not granted to them under the law in many countries because they can't own property in the same way that men can. They can't initiate divorce in the same way that men can. And I think that there's a lot to be done in that area. I don't think it's useful to think in terms of the right to infect anyone. And I think that the scenario that your question comes from speaks to how inadequately, in spite of mountains of gender analysis, we have really seen resources flow to, first of all, address the whole matter of awareness of rights and people's legal protection of rights of men and women within marriage, within any other institution. We are really not there. What drives, you depicted this in one way. I would say what is driving HIV in that case is the subordination of women, which is nowhere to be seen on policy agendas in most settings where that is, in fact, an important determinant of the epidemic. What difference has it made that there is a global fund for the matter of subordination of women as an important driving factor for HIV? Women seem to be missing from the coordinating mechanisms. I think that there's a lot to do, and I don't think that a kind of false application of human rights language helps us. I think what we really need is to see the gender inequity basis of HIV/AIDS and actually do something about it for a change.
Miriam?
To the lady from Johns Hopkins, same-sex counselling is one of the strategies we are suggesting and implementing. It's not yet a nationwide policy, and that's because of discussions about human resource constraints, especially in government public health centres in villages where maybe only one government member of staff is doing VCT counselling at any one time. On the question about training, Kenya has a 126-hour training curriculum. It's a residential three-week course, and most of the participants are already qualified healthcare workers. There is also training for lay counsellors. That is followed by a compulsory period of observed practice, and you have to be seen to counsel X number of clients, and so many of them must have tested positive, so many B couples. We have a 20% failure rate on the course, so the selection criteria that people make before the counselling training are getting more and more stringent because nobody wants to pay that money and have their candidate not pass. The training takes into account a lot of issues around values and attitudes and sex and sexuality, and as well as issues around gender and gender norms in society. It's quite a values-based training as well as skills-based practical approach to training. It's a balance. You're making VCT counsellors, you're not making professional therapeutic counsellors, and it's about how long people can be released from government services who are meant to be providing other healthcare services. Remember, these are a minority of experiences, although the way I've presented it is maybe that it's happening all the time. And I think regardless of the training, even if you had highly qualified professional counsellors, this would be happening.
Thanks, Miriam. There's a few questions that have come from upstairs, so I'll pose this one, but then we'll ask for two more speakers from the floor down here. The question is, what's your opinion about household testing and providing results to respondents in the house? This is being considered in Kenya, and I think it's likely that that's directed at Joanne. It was from Laurie Liskin and someone based in the U.S. Can we get this microphone? Sorry, let's start with microphone one.
Thanks. My name's Ian McLeod. I work with UNICEF. I want to thank all the presenters to start off with. It's very interesting presentations. The one thing I did notice was the sort of a homogeneity in terms of the age. Well, there was no discussion in terms of age around the rights to counselling and testing. And I'm wondering if we could hear a little bit from Miriam and Sunday about practical experiences ensuring that children and adolescents have the rights to access counselling and testing. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Joachim Osur. I come from Kenya. I work with IPPF. My question goes to Francis, this experience in Malawi with routine testing. What is the quality of life of people who test positive after routine counseling? I mean, routine testing. How is the family support? How is adherence to treatment? I'm thinking that these are people who may not have thought about HIV in the first place, and here they come for antenatal clinic and they are tested, and they suddenly have to start thinking about a lot of things and disclosure and so on. Secondly, Francis, for whose benefit is routine counseling and testing? Because VCT is client-based. For whose benefit is routine testing?
Could Sunday answer the question, followed by Miriam and then Francis?
The question on household testing, was that?
That was, yes, I think, was for me. Yes, household testing. I think we've seen this come up in a very active way in Lesotho, where if there isn't already, there will soon be, as I understand it, a door-to-door campaign. I think we heard in the plenary session this morning the head of the AIDS program in Rwanda tell us that the majority of women in her country do not deliver their children in a health facility. I believe that there need to be strategies to be sure that people are offered tests. Obviously, people should have good access to HIV testing, but I believe that HIV testing contributes most to universal access when it has those protections of confidentiality, of counseling, and of... I can't even consent. Remember three C's up to... and consent, sorry. It's hard enough to monitor what happens in that regard in a health facility. Monitoring how those things are play out in a household will be a great challenge. So I think that this is going to be, in addition, I believe that there is a real confidentiality challenge for any kind of process like this that happens within a household, especially if we're in a place where women, for instance, are not allowed to have a one-on-one conversation in private without a male member of the family being present. So I think we're talking here about a real concern about being sure that resources are there so that if in the household setting it's not possible to maintain confidentiality, there are ways to deal with that. I think also, and I think this with respect to all of the routine provider-initiated models that have been proposed, that governments really do have to seriously allow for independent monitoring, and that needs to be very, very well funded.
Since I've got a microphone and you can't stop me, I want to add some comments on the home, on the household testing. I think it could be a good idea, provided that the quality assurance measures are there. But I get anxious about, you know, how is it paid for? It's so expensive. Is it sustainable? What does it mean in the long term? And we're trying to integrate these services into primary healthcare centres, where they're a service like any other. Why is HIV testing so special? It's being taken to people's homes, and what does that mean in the future for the government and for sustainability of these services? So I think it's a good idea if we can maintain the quality, but I have question marks around it. To fail to address the question from UNICEF, the VCT guidelines in Kenya enshrine the rights of mature minors, in other words, young people who are sexually active, But there is a gap around children, and I think Dr. Ndwati raised that this morning very well in the plenary. And I wouldn't say that the VCT guidelines have done much to protect the rights of children in testing, and it's a gap.
Okay.
I think that it's a good idea, as it's been said, to engage in household counseling, especially the issue of couple counseling. I think it will be very helpful. In terms of the rights of children and the issue of age, our work was mainly concentrated on people preparing for marriage and people who are married in the church, even though it's generally to promote healthy VCT counseling, VCT in the church setting. So for children, it will be important that consent be sought from their parents.
Okay, regarding the issue of quality of life after testing, I think this has been a very dynamic process since the advent of testing. People were initially very scared. They went through a lot of abuse in the early stages. Now, as life has progressed, as various treatment options, various options for people who are infected has come on board, the quality of life of people who are getting tested and are testing positive has improved over time. This is not to say that there is no problem. Yes, there is problem. But because there's a problem, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to solve the problem. There is a problem, and we'll continue to find ways and means of dealing with the issue of the quality of life after testing until we found the right solution to it. As to who benefits from routine testing, as a clinician and public health scientist, I'll say both the individual and society. The individual, because once the individual knows his or her status, he's able to lead a life that can help him or her live longer. As to society, yes, society is able to help that person also live a better life. Society is able to know how many people need extra help so that they're able to help them in that direction. As far as our clinicians and other public health specialists are concerned, it gives them an opportunity to plan as to what kind of health service delivery are needed to help everybody.
Thank you. Okay, we have another question from the floor. This one is from upstairs. Could you tell who provides the VCT consultation in the churches? So I assume it's aimed at Sunday. Is it a healthcare specialist or is it a volunteer? Then we'll take from microphone 3 and then back to 1.
Alan Berkman from Columbia University. First, thank you in particular for putting the issue of rapid testing and routine testing together. I always have the vision of a pregnant woman being happy about being pregnant, coming to the ANC, and leaving a few hours later just having been told that she has a potentially fatal disease that she can transmit to her infant. So I think this issue of anxiety for rapid testing, it may be a problem for the provider, for the counselor. I think it's potentially a huge problem for the person who receives the result of rapid testing. I guess my question is that in these discussions, there's an assumption that people who are positive change their behavior. And I guess I have a question for anybody on the panel, that everything I've ever seen that documents that was a VCT. Now we're switching, and that meant people voluntarily wanted to be tested. And by a behavior change analysis, they were more ready to change their behavior. Now we're switching to a whole new paradigm, and yet we're still using the same understanding from a whole different VCT model. Has anybody ever seen any data that supports that? Or has anybody ever seen another example where we've done a huge natural experiment of subjecting people to stigma? and the adverse events that might flow from that. Thank you.
Go ahead. Go ahead, ask your question.
Thank you. My name is Theo Lyons, and I'm a high school student in Canada. And my question relates again to the stories of abuse, and it's really that I'm left a little bit confused having heard these appalling stories and then recently been told that the counselors were reasonably trained and that apparently the abuse would most likely continue even with professional counselors. So my question really is, what is the message? Is the system in Kenya, is it adequate in your opinion? And what can be done to improve conditions if they need to be improved in the scale up, which is so clearly needed today? Thank you.
Okay, I like it. Maybe Joanne could take the first, the question on from Ellen, and then maybe Sunday would like to take it.
Yeah, I don't think I can say much more than Alan Bergman has already said with that question, but I found it interesting. WHO has recently, I think, gotten some a team from Johns Hopkins actually to review what they consider the experimental and good observational studies on various models of testing, and that was done prior to a consultation, I think, in June in Geneva about models of testing. And it is interesting that the only experimental design we have is indeed, as you say, with VCT, and those are very few studies. As these, it's really the monitoring and evaluation and research questions, including the ethical questions on how we even begin to look at these things in routine models, I think is an important challenge. But certainly in the consultation that I was reporting on, this came up again, the point that you make came up again and again. How is it that in the provider-initiated situations, the preventive value of the transfer of information or counseling can be preserved, and is there really any interest in doing that? Again, if you know, we have to keep asking ourselves, what is the reason for this routine testing? If the main, or provider-initiated testing, if the main motivation is to raise those rates of uptake, that's one thing. But when are we going to start looking in our research at what the behavior change outcomes look like?
Okay, I'll be responding to the question on visiting a church setting, who to provide professionals or volunteers. In the church setting, from my experience, pastors, volunteers will be effective in providing VCT provided they are given adequate training, capacity building, and there is a continuous monitoring and evaluation and mentoring going with that.
Mine is to reply to Theo. I think you're right to be shocked, but I think this is a much wider problem than Kenya alone. And again, within Kenya, it's a minority of interactions that are happening, and you need to keep that in mind. It is a minority, although it's a shocking story. The reason I think it's a wider problem is that it touches on gender and power norms in society and on vulnerability and on vulnerable situations. And Kenya is known for its very good quality VCT program and exceptional effort it's put into quality assurance with Scale Up. And I would say specifically that Liverpool VCT has spearheaded some of that. But it also takes a lot of bravery for a program or a country to come out and say that this is happening, and it is happening. And all I can think is that if it's happening to us, with the effort we've put into quality assurance, it's happening much more widely. And that needs to be tackled through some of the different methods we've raised and other suggestions.
Can I just add a clarification to that as the chair, because I think it's important in settings like this one for the question around the high school student, is that often in international settings when we talk about things that happen, especially in African settings, it is easy to take something out of context and misunderstand what's happening there.
And I think what people often get drawn to is the appalling, shocking story. And I think it was used for illustrative effect in the presentation. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, that it's indicative of larger issues around sexual violence and so on, but that it could have easily, just as easily happened in any other context, given that gender-based violence is something that happens worldwide. So I don't want us to misunderstand why the example was offered. Yeah? Okay, let's take another round of questions. Let's start with microphone 2, so that's this side.
Okay.
And then we'll go to microphone 3 in the center, and then we'll go to microphone 3, 1 over there.
Okay, hi, my name is Shaman Mohammed Jr. I'm from Toronto. I'm the founder of letsstopaids.org. And my question is, first of all, I'll just tell you, as running a nonprofit organization and returning last month from South Africa, our organization is now moving into a new step, which we're getting interested in HIV, rapid HIV testing. And what we've been doing more research on, since we work with children in rural environments and orphans, we're trying to see right now to analyze different reasons for safety concerns and just concerns about a procedure of how we can ensure, since our organization mainly operates in Canada and the work would be taught to wherever the third world country would be, would you have any direct advice, especially since our organization does is growing and it's one big concern for us about the safety, especially since it would be dealing with children all the way from the age of 6 all the way to 21.
Okay, we'll take the next question. Thank you for that. In the middle?
Yeah, Maysu Ndeha from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Allow me to paraphrase a couple of comments that were made by healthcare workers in a setting that we work with in South Africa regarding the effect of not routine testing, but very recommended testing on the efficacy of treatment with patients. With this healthcare worker saying, and this is again a paraphrasing of their comments, when the program started, we were pushed to test and put on treatment as many people as possible. Many people were started on treatment too early. We have targets. Once we have targets, it will be quantity over quality. It will be a never-ending cycle of default or non-adherent. I suppose my question to the panel is if they are aware of any studies that have evaluated the effect of routine testing on the adherence of patients later on and also on their retention to the programs once they get started on treatment. This is especially considering that we all agree that people should have the opportunity to test, should have the opportunity to go to treatment, but also should have the right to succeed on treatment. Thank you.
Thanks for that question.
My name is Torkil Tulusher. I'm at the Center for International Health, University of Bergen. I have a comment and a question. The comment is that I think that routine testing is really the thing to come. 10 years from now, it's going to be all over the place. And I'm in many places, there is a maturation. In the first place, when you start with testing, nobody dares to really talk out, speak out about it and so on. And then with time, when it becomes more of a routine, the shoulders get down and people get at ease. And for instance, I'm collaborating with the Makerere University Department of Pediatrics, where testing was not an issue. Severely malnourished children, we looked at them and we installed routine testing for all of the children and their with the consent of the parents and the pre-test counseling and everything. And acceptance was almost 100%. I mean, above 90%. So people really wanted this, and they were happy that it happened. And also, looking in another end of the world, in Sweden, there was a poster the other day that the last mother-to-child transmission in Sweden happened in 1999. Since then, they have had 230 deliveries without any transmission at all. Why is that? One reason is that there is routine testing opt-out for all pregnant women in Sweden. The question is, when you start with routine counseling and testing, there is worries that what happens to the women, for instance, in an antenatal setting, when if they come out 1 hour later and they know that they're HIV positive. One of the problems in the PMTCT setting is that if the women are going to take drugs...
I'm sorry,
and so
we're
on,
running low on time,
yeah.
So...
Then they need support. What about looking into the issue of couple counseling and pushing the issue of having somebody with the lady when the routine counseling is happening?
Thanks for that last question. I think people are clear on the questions that have been directed at them. I'd like to add to the last question, and Joanne is taking the first question that was asked. I'd like to add to the question around couple testing, which came up in one of the presentations, and it hasn't been addressed by anyone in the audience, which is what's the thinking around the group testing and the ethics and confidentiality issues that are raised there in the Malawi example that was provided. So if we'll kick off with Joanne again and take it down the row with the rest of the responses. We have 5 minutes left. Depending on how quickly the panel is able to answer the questions, then we will then take a last round of questions.
Very, very quickly, Shaman, I think you're actually very lucky because, in my view, you're in the place that has the best experience and documented experience on rapid testing and what that means for counseling and guidelines, and that is the Hassle-Free Clinic here in Toronto, one of the most established anonymous testing clinics in the world. They documented with McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, an experience in a monograph that you can get on the McMaster University AIDS program website, a fabulous document, and I recommend it highly to everyone as a compliment to the many wonderful things also that Denise was talking about from Brazil. It's really an excellent document about what it means for the counselor, what it means for the person being tested, and can give you a lot of guidance. On the question of the group testing, we, of course, probably want to hear from Francis. WHO has actually said at various times in guidelines that part of pretest counseling should be a chance to be able to ask questions in confidence, including questions about sex and questions about HIV. I think that's my concern in the stories about group counseling, which I have myself witnessed many times in the 12 or so years I worked in Africa. It may be in some settings that you have a group of women, for instance, who are comfortable enough with each other so that there is some level of being able to ask very delicate questions. It may be not. And I think that's also a challenge with couples counseling, which nonetheless I'm sure holds great promise, especially for reduction of violence and abuse in some settings. On the matter of routine testing is the thing of the future, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years, it was an acceptable idea in international policy discussions on HIV/AIDS that in resource-limited settings, people just won't have access to antiretroviral drugs. It's not feasible. We've been through 3x5. We certainly don't have that idea anymore. I think the thing of the future should be that people have a right in all countries, even resource-limited countries, to good information, to information that comes to them in an accessible way from people they can have confidence in, from people who are well-trained and well-supported, and that is the thing of the future. And I don't see why that needs to be incompatible with ratcheting up HIV testing.
Couple counseling will really help in solving the problem of men who wouldn't want to disclose their status to their wives. This is a huge problem in the part of Nigeria where I work, and it's important that, to note that it is effective from our experience in the northern part of Nigeria, especially in the Christian setting. Couples see themselves as one, and that makes it easier for them to accept couple counseling. The problem comes when there is no, the counseling is not comprehensive, and when it's not offered in a progressive way, you know.
Very briefly, I'm not aware of any studies that look at follow-up and adherence following routine testing, but I think the lady who asked that question has gone. I think it's a study that needs to be designed, and we're working on it with the follow-up of diagnostic testing. compared to VCT.
Okay. Addressing the general epidemic, I think we are in a situation where we have something in our hands that we have never come across as humankind. It is up to us as humankind to fall on all the tools that we know and to modify them as we go along to make the tools more effective for dealing with the issue. There was VCT initially. Over the years, as treatment has become more available and other items in the fight have become more readily available, these tools are being sharpened in a way that can deal with the situation in various places. Before, yes, we were doing individual counseling. Maybe at that time, we didn't have the resources to deal with the numbers that were going to come in, or we did have the resources to deal with the numbers that were coming in. So that was an adequate tool. As the years have gone by, we are noticing that using group counseling, as people have become more knowledgeable with HIV activities, becoming a more effective tool on the ground than having a one-on-one kind of transaction with people, and that people tend to learn more from their peers in these discussions than having a one-on-one kind of interaction. And as we move along, we ensure that we'll pick up more tools which may make this even more effective in the provision of RCT.
I'm just going to thank the presenters for their presentations and your participation. I'm sorry that we've run out of time, but we'd like you to probably come and approach the speakers afterwards. I'm just going to let Sonke wrap up the session.
I really don't think there's any need for wrap up. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.